All right, welcome everybody to Heads and Tails Podcast. This show is going to get me in trouble, I think, Warren.
Yeah, we have five whiskeys, and only one of them is not barrel strength.
Oh, sweet Lord. Yeah, you know, you're pouring the spirits into our nice little sample glasses, and I can smell all the sweet, you know, aromatics of the spirits, man. And I can't imagine that this is the timeline that we're part of right now in the world.
Your timeline's getting better.
That's definitely
here
true.
We are.
For a guest on this month's show, we have Iron Root Republic Distillery from Denison, Texas, which is way up north there, almost Oklahoma territory.
Almost.
Yeah.
And they're doing a lot of whiskey.
They're doing a lot of whiskey, and apparently it's a lot with like corn and corn blends and different kinds of corn.
Yeah.
And
that's all they have out there, right?
Sure. I have no idea. I'm super fascinated about it. I'm really interested to talk to them about it. We're going to have Jonathan and Robert on, two brothers.
Oh, nice.
Apparently.
The Licorice Brothers.
The Licorice Brothers?
Yeah.
Oh, I guess, yeah. I was like, I'm not even going to try anybody's last name because I'm just bad at it. I can barely remember people's first names. It looks great. I've seen photos of the distillery online, reading a bunch of articles. They've won tons of awards already. Really looking forward to it.
They've only been around for about 5 years now almost.
So yeah, something like that.
Relatively new on the scene for whiskey.
It's not the prettiest distillery. It used to be a boat. They repaired boats there or something. It's sort of... looks like every other building you've ever seen.
Oh, the location?
Yes.
Okay, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But
yeah.
I do believe they are looking at other locations to expand into as well.
Nice. And Eric from ADI, of course, is sitting in, who's slowly becoming apparently our third chair, Warren.
Yes.
Yeah, he just took over.
He's just coming in. But he brought some spirits. You guys had your annual tasting, your judging, not tasting, right?
Yeah, the judging was this week at the Lodge at Tiburon. Not a bad location to taste some spirits.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Nice views of SF off in the distance.
Nice.
And, yeah, a little 3 days of tasting spirits, 2 days straight. Last day is the grand panel, and it all wraps up.
Okay.
About 50 people out there, 50 judges, 15 stewards. It's three of the best days of the year for us.
Right.
Yes.
I can imagine. And you were saying before the show went on that the stewards get first dibs on bottles, like to just take home.
Well, I think so. Yes. I don't know how much I'm supposed to be talking about.
No.
This is more of an Eric Zandona question. But yes, there are perks.
Well, we know what Eric did. He took all of the bottles he wanted first.
That's true. Well, you know what? That's a perk in and of itself.
True.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate the invite. I definitely want to get out there next year. Maybe we can plan for it, Warren. And,
yeah.
But I don't know if you'll even be here.
Maybe we could judge for
what
it.
What do you mean?
That's true. All right, well, let's get the boys on the line. We should have Jonathan and Robert right now from Iron Root Republic Distillery. Can you guys hear us?
We can hear you.
Yeah.
Perfect. How you guys doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Excellent. Excellent. Thanks for joining us today.
No problem.
So let me start off with just asking a general question about the name, Iron Root Republic. Where does that come from, and how does that fit in with your guys' culture of where you want the distillery to be and what you want it to be representative of?
So Iron Root comes from the history of Denison itself, the city that we're located in. It's a little bit of a long story, but back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, a gentleman lived in Denison whose name was T.V. Munson. He was a kind of a famous American viticulturist, and what his big goal was try to figure out how to grow European grapes in the United States, because we have all these diseases that would kill grapes, a lot of grapes after a few years, especially something called phylloxera. And so he discovered that there was actually a Texas grape root that is because of how thick and hardy it is, it's actually fairly immune to phylloxera. Around that same time, phylloxera had been transferred over to France and wiped out, I think it was nearly 80% of the French grapes.
Wow.
Cognac was completely decimated. And so they had been sending basically scientists out to the U.S. to see if they could do anything to fight it. And so T.V. Munson met up with one of their scientists, and they discovered that this Texas root was the source to a lot of their problems. So they actually started using the Texas grape roots with a lot of their native grapes, like Full Blanche, to order to start regrowing those plants, those grapes in cognac. So it's one of the things that they say helped save the cognac industry. And so for that reason, Denison and cognac are sister cities. I mean, we have a really close relationship with a lot of the, as far as city-wise and sister city stuff. For that reason, Jonathan and I have had the pleasure of working with some of the French distillers and talking with them. It's been a really great relationship for us. And it kind of works with us because we actually were trained by Nancy Fraley, and really a lot of what we do comes from more of a brandy tradition, from how we run the stills to how we do aging in the warehouse. So I say it's the iron grape roots from Texas that save the cognac industry.
From Phylloxera. I think my grandpa used to take Phylloxera.
That's why you're so hardy
every day.
That's right, yeah. He never lived a better life, I'll tell you that right now. So you talked about training. What kind of training did you guys get, and how did you bring it, you know, into your distillery and the spirits that you're producing?
So I mean, early on when we were back working on trying to figure out just whether we wanted to be a distillery or start a distillery or not, we actually started looking to see what kind of programs are in place. And the reality is there wasn't a whole lot out there back in 2008, 2009 time period. So ADI was doing some really great stuff. I know you've met with those guys before. But one of the people that puts on classes through them is Hubert Germain Robon. He's a famous distiller out in California. He started a brandy distillery, Germain Robon. And he's actually a master cognac distiller that had come over from cognac. So him and one of his apprentices, Nancy Fraley, do a lot of do brandy classes. So I ended up going out there and taking some classes from them, and kind of fell in love with brandy and how the French approach distilling. And from there, Jonathan and I kind of toured around the rest of the U.S. and doing internships and working with distilleries all across the country, and then decided to start our own.
Okay. What's different, and I don't want to, you don't have to give away any secrets. You don't have to, but if you want to, you're more than welcome to. How does what the French were doing, how does it differ in from what you were doing or from what you knew? And then, I guess more importantly, how do you apply that to something that is such a, like an American spirit like bourbon?
Well, there's a couple of differences out the gate in the production side, and some of them get pretty technical as far as controlling your condensing water differently in order to influence the aromatics that are coming off the still, et cetera. But kind of the thing that we can most apply to, say, bourbon actually happens in the warehouse, where bourbon is typically, real heavy oak, and especially in Texas. So what we found is using some French cognac techniques, we can actually kind of mitigate some of that wood extraction and try and kind of keep that in balance with the rest of the spirit in and of itself, as well as the aromatics of the spirit.
Okay. Okay. So you're trying to control how much oak impact you're getting into your spirit. Is that just because you don't really like overly oaky spirits, or because you guys are working with corn, which we'll get to in a little bit, but different varietals of corn, and you want that to show through more, or is it any one thing?
It's going to be a mixture of all of those. So one of them, like you mentioned, we do use some heirloom corns, and we really want to kind of highlight those flavors. And if you do over oak it, it's just going to cover it up.
Right.
Like I said before, it gets really extreme in Texas. So sometimes the oak down here can stick out more like a sore thumb than as kind of an interesting aspect of that whiskey.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all that things get extreme in Texas. I think that's where the X Games were founded. Actually, that's right. Well, let's talk some corn and some heirloom corn. What made you guys go with heirloom corn versus just the? I imagine everybody else uses just generic yellow corn,
like the Safeway corn,
like Safeway corn,
Tom Hill corn.
sometimes. most commonly used is just going to be a yellow dent. There's a ton of different varieties of yellow dent out there. And what's mostly grown in our area, specifically up by Denison, is going to be corn and wheat, and mostly corn. So we kind of wanted to go with what was in our local area. That's kind of where we focus first, is on local. So about 95% of our current grain usage comes within about 60 miles of the distillery.
Oh, wow.
So that being said, we did kind of specify down the type of corn we wanted to use from there. So we use a non-GMO yellow dent corn for that specifically because it has a little bit higher protein content to it. A lot of those yellow dents are bred for things other than distilling. So in case of just for flavor, you're going to want to get a pretty sweet corn. You're going to have a lot of sugar to a lot of carbohydrate. From a different type of distilling aspect, if you want to make ethanol fuel, you want a bunch of carbohydrate. Sometimes when you're looking for flavor, that's actually on a different side of the coin. So that's actually in the protein content or the amino acid. When we look at our corns, we're really looking for more protein content. I mean, we still have to have enough in order for us to make whiskey.
Right.
But we still want a lot of flavor and to kind of build that complexity.
Okay.
When I first met Jonathan, I asked him, he made sure to point out that they were non-GMO. And I was like, you know, you're in Texas. I wouldn't imagine your customers are so interested in it being GMO versus non-GMO. That seems more like a West Coast Whole Foods type thing.
Right,
and
in Berkeley.
Yeah, it is that sort of difference between corn that's grown for cattle feed versus heritage varietals. And so I had always sort of wondered about what does non-GMO mean. And so after talking to Jonathan, it's about heritage varietals with more flavor and
yeah, right, more of the stuff that they're looking for in the finished spirit versus in a gas tank.
Yeah.
Right. Sounds like
cows aren't as picky.
Yeah, that's right. Well, how do you develop a blend of corns? How do you develop a recipe? That's what kind of interests me a lot in the spirits world, in your guys' world, especially from a relatively new distillery. How do you figure out how to make a spirit that's going to age? And then know what it's going to taste like at the end.
I think at some levels we don't know what some of them are going to taste like at the end.
Okay.
A lot of them will start out as experiments, and it helps out to be ADD. So we like experimenting. I mean, Jonathan, he just finished ordering the different corns for this year's experimentations, but we kind of like running the house where we have our four kind of core main mash bills that we do. Again, three of those feature different heirloom corns, and then one has a little bit of rye in it. And then we have what we call the ADD set of mash bills that we do every year, where we're trying out new varietals that we found that, again, Jonathan's, it's like Christmas Day when he gets the seed book around here. He's flipping through it and reading it, opening whatever he can.
How's
new? What new rainbow color of corn he can find that year?
Right.
And so, again, it's one of those things that we put it down. We try it off the still. A lot of times that'll give us a really good idea of what we're going to be dealing with ultimately, whether we're dealing with a little bit spicier or herbal grain, or whether you have something that's going to be really sweet or floral. And you can get a lot of early notes off of just the distillate off the still. But what really shows is about a year and a half to 2 years into the barrel, really what you're going to be dealing with ultimately. And so that's when things get really exciting around here.
Yeah, as opposed to kind of your traditional bourbon technique where you're going to end up having your flavoring grain either be wheat or rye.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our mash bills will actually use other types of corn as the flavoring grain. So we kind of took – it's kind of a traditional approach by having a flavoring grain, but it's not traditional in the fact that it's corn.
Okay.
So it's corn on top of corn in some mash bills. And we like to keep them fairly clean to where we have just, say, two different corns in one mash bill. So basically our base corn and then the flavoring corn. And when we do it that way, we can really tell what those flavors are of that specific corn at the end of the day.
Hmm. So it's not, you're not just trying different stuff and go, oh, that doesn't work. Let me throw this out and try something new. It's, I'm going to commit to making, to running this or filling however many barrels at a time. And then, you know, if that doesn't work, I'll look back at my notes from when I did this a year ago and go, okay, let's tweak this recipe out or this percentage out.
Yeah, we originally thought, hey, let's try and do small batch and kind of, you know, do some tests on it. And then everything seemed to work out pretty well with our techniques on using the flavoring grain. So we do about five barrels at a time as for our experiments.
Oh, wow.
And if it tastes really good off the still, we may lay down 10. So
that's your first indicator.
There is the dynamic between the two brothers, too. Robert's sort of the business side of things, and Jonathan's more the science side of things. And Jonathan's always pushing it out there, like, more experiments, but Robert's like, gotta pay the bills. We can only you only have these experiments, so make most of them.
And I think you need that in a partnership. You know what I mean? It's like Roy and Walt Disney. I don't know. Sorry. To be
There's
stupid.
Gotta be a gas and a brake.
That's right.
Otherwise, it's a bad car.
Right. Last thing you want to do is pop it in neutral and just go.
Are you guys?
We haven't tried that yet, but
now that you guys have been around long enough, are you getting to really see that the results of the first round of experiments to where now you get to actually apply what you've been learning?
In fact, we just finished tasting the first real round of experiments after our. I'll say our first initial stuff as we were getting started, but the first real experiments we just tasted, I'd say, earlier this week. So, because they all just hit 2 years old. So it was really exciting time this week tasting through the barrel room. There's definitely one corn that I can tell you that we went back and have now engaged a farmer to start growing more of that corn for us because that's going to be going into a much wider production. Just because of how wonderful it turned out.
Nice.
Does it make you optimistic or concerned about last year's experiments?
optimistic.
Yeah.
Yes.
There we go.
Good.
Maybe knock on wood, we actually haven't had any experiments that weren't something that we could use or thought we were going to have to dump them down the drain.
Yeah, I can imagine you're not going super far out in the left field with some, you know, weird ingredient. You want to keep it a little bit contained in some sort of, you know, usefulness.
Yeah, most of the time.
Fair enough.
Yeah, once in a while, we'll have something that's a little crazy out in left field.
Yeah.
There's one experiment back in the back. I don't know what we're going to be able to call it or what it's going to be, but
it's delicious.
It's tasty, but I don't know what we're going to do with it yet.
That's more of a federal labeling thing.
What's so special about it? What's weird about it?
It's made from mesquite beans and not like the pods being like boiled like they normally would do. This is actually opening up the pods and taking these tiny seeds
and then ground them into a flour
and then using that in a whiskey mash bill.
I think I spoke too soon when I said it's not like you're, you know, taking weird stuff. Is that common? Is that like a common thing to use mesquite pod flour for other stuff and you just incorporate it? Or you guys just were drinking a lot one night?
It's used in some like cookies, and some people use it for different baking aspects.
Okay.
So I think it's mostly in diabetic cuisine because of the sugars in it. But we used it just in a small percentage with that yellow dent. So it was the non-GMO corn that we have. So it was a calculated risk on it.
There you go. What flavors did you get out of it?
Oh, that's the greatest part about it. So we were a little bit lucky in the fact that we distilled both bourbon and brandy here.
Okay.
Because it was kind of a combination of both. So a lot of the cuts at the front, right when the heads were coming off and things like that, that was a lot like you're doing cuts on brandy as opposed to bourbon.
Huh.
But on the tails end of it, it was much more like cutting whiskey.
A bunch of whiskey fusels on the back end.
Yeah. And it still feels a little bit like brandy and whiskey mixed together in the barrel. So it's
brisky.
I think it's good.
Yeah. It's a brisky. Right. When you said federal labeling issue, is that because of the shutdown, as we're talking about? Like you're ready to go, or you just don't know what to call it legally?
No, we don't. It's going to have to be a distilled spirit specialty because the government has no idea what to do with distilled beans.
All right.
Technically, it's a legume.
Yeah, legume. So that's not something that they've ever dealt with before. So I imagine we'll have to send it in for sampling for them to make sure.
Sure. I bet it'll be a very speedy process, too. Don't worry about it.
Oh, most definitely. It always is.
We don't know what this is. Sure. Why not? We'll trust you guys.
Maybe now's the time to do it and just be like, hey, you guys weren't in the office, so you know,
yeah,
too late.
You know what? There is.
Anyway,
we were going to find it. Intern day.
That's right. We were on our beer show on the session. We were reading a story about a Washington, D.C. brewery that's suing the government for the shutdown because they want to release beer, but they couldn't get label approval. And they're like, well, it's, you know, you're infringing what on my First Amendment rights of free speech. So I wonder if you can do that. And they're looking for relief from the government to be like, hey, you can't sue, or please don't sue us, or, you know, whatever the language is. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. But, you know, you can't come after us if we release our kegs and our bottles without federal label approval. So, you know, maybe Warren's right. Maybe now is the time.
Yeah, ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah, stake your whole future on this one weird...
Slip it past the goalie.
That's right. Yeah. Well, let's taste some spirits, Warren, because I keep smelling it, and now I'm really thirsty.
Yeah. Do you guys have a recommendation as far as a tasting order between the corn whiskey and the three bourbons that we have?
We generally start lower proof and work our way up, okay. With the exception of one that you have there called Icarus. So we'll probably save that one for last.
Okay.
All right. So let's see. I have a list of the proofs here, Warren, unless you know them off the top of your weird head.
Well, they're on the bottles. Okay. At least 190 proof.
The XC bourbon.
That's the low.
Which is right here. Okay. What's XC?
That's the Roman numeral for 90.
Oh.
When we were naming the, it's actually the lower proof version of one of the other whiskeys we're going to try in a second, called Harbinger. I didn't want to call it, you know, Little Harbinger or Weak Harbinger or something like that. So we thought XC sounded better.
Well, and you confuse dummies like me and going like, what is it? It's probably for something cool. You know,
it sounds extra cool. That one.
It really does.
XC actually stands for.
Yeah. Yeah. 90 proof. All right.
Yeah. So this is kind of our intro whiskey. It's blended to be kind of sweet and easy drinking, really.
Okay. Smells great.
So as far as mash billing it, so when Rob was talking about our four core mash bills,
yeah,
we do those and then we age them up, and then depending how we blend those barrels in different ratios depends on which product we get at the end. So if you're familiar in the bourbon world, probably the closest thing to how we do things production wise probably Four Roses, where they have multiple mash bills and multiple yeast that they use and things like that.
Okay.
And so what we do with this one is we actually lean a little bit heavier on two of our heirloom corns. For flavor, and so this one is going to have a lot of the purple corn flavor that we have, as well as something called Bloody Butcher corn.
Why is that familiar? We've talked about Bloody Butcher corn too before, right?
Yeah, so there are other distillers using Bloody Butcher right now.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see why. That's marketing right there.
Dark berry flavor to it, so it's real popular.
Yeah. It was a couple episodes ago.
Okay.
The name is Brown... And Wright and Brown?
Wright and Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Earl from Wright and Brown.
Yes.
Yeah, the nose definitely smells like corn. And that makes no sense. Not like cooked corn. And I know a lot of people, you know, like corn on the cob. Not like that at all. It's like a grainy, starchy thing. But with that sweet backbone, that malt backbone, and I'm sure there's a lot of barrel character in there too, it just really sets the tone for what you're going to be. What you're going to be tasting. It's not super aggressive. It's very, I don't know how to describe it.
I'm not sure that I've had a bourbon where it's reminded me of like opening up the door on a corn silo, like getting like that, just like.
Sure, we've all done that.
Dry, I mean, I knew that's what you were thinking about.
Yeah. Actually, I used to live in the corn silo.
Lot of bourbons.
I'm the Harry Potter of corn. Yeah.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah. A lot of bourbons will have that big burn on the front or the big burn on the back. This is so nice and smooth,
yeah, and
especially for a three-year-old product.
Yeah, and I think that corn aroma is kind of either containing or hiding or whatever, but it is making it very much more approachable, I think, than a normal... Norbert, where's the there's the bottle.
Yep.
So this is 24 months, it says on the bottle here.
Yep. So it ranged, so barrels in this range from 2 years to about 3.5 years old. We're only a 4.5 year old distillery, so we're still working on aging. We're still aging everything up in the warehouse still. So
if I claim to have a 5 year old whiskey, be a little suspicious.
Noted.
And the term straight is something that you can only put on the label if it's a minimum of 2 years, correct?
Correct.
There's a couple other stipulations, but yeah, that's kind of the big thing is 2 years.
What are the others?
If it's a straight bourbon, well, if it's a straight whiskey in general, you can't have any additives or any flavorings put into it. So bourbon in and of itself is protected that way as well. So, but in a lot of whiskeys,
it's only 2 years.
Yeah, with bourbon, it means 2 years. But with other whiskeys, that straight term has a little bit more meaning.
Okay.
I really enjoy this. I am getting some of those kind of darker, almost berry-like flavors that you guys were talking about. And you said that's from the Bloody Butcher corn?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So
I get it's. I don't want to say dried cranberry, but it's like if a dried cranberry wasn't super tart and aggressive like dried cranberries can be, or sweet, but it's just the... I don't know what the skin maybe of the cranberry, so like the tannin. You know what I'm trying to say? It's not bright. Definitely. It's not aggressive. It's not tart. It's not tangy, but it tastes like that kind of
just like dark fruity esters kind of thing.
Yeah,
yeah.
I like it.
That's really good.
Thank you.
Is this only those two types of corn, and there isn't any barley or rye or anything else in this?
There's no barley in there, but there is going to be some rye.
Okay.
There's going to be some. So our bourbons have all four of those corn mash bills. The rye and then one of the other corns are going to be backed off at a lower percentage in this particular blend. Mm. The next one we do, it's going to flip flop. So the purple corn and the Bloody Butcher are going to be on the lower proportion, and we'll have rye and something called flint corn kind of coming out in the forefront. And so hopefully you'll be able to see the difference between those flavors right out the gate.
Okay, which one should we try next?
Promethean.
Promethean, here we go. I dig these little bottles, man. They're a little like, pocket to travel size.
The sample bottle, yeah. So we like those. They travel really well, too, like you said.
So. Slip in your back pocket and go to town.
Easy to hold on to while you're driving.
They've got that little bow in the glass so you can slide it in your hip pocket.
Yeah, exactly. Do you sell them like that or no?
No, that's more for sample purposes for you guys. So we only do the one full-size bottle. That's the 750 milliliter bottles.
Okay. All right. Well, we all have Promethean now in our glass.
Sure.
Tell me a little bit about this guy.
So Promethean was the second whiskey that we released. It's going to be 103 proof. So it's kind of in the middle range of proofs for us. We tend to lean on the high proof. Just that's what Jonathan and I like. So most of our whiskeys tend to be higher proof. So this one, as you said, leans a little bit higher. It has a little bit more rye in the final mash bill in the blend, as well as that flint corn, which flint corn, if you're not familiar with, is almost a little bit more like popcorn. So it's actually a little bit, when it comes off the still, it's a little bit spicier of a distillate.
Yeah, this one in particular, Nick. We kiddingly say sometimes that it gives us flavors like a Mexican chocolate. So it's like chocolate and cayenne pepper sprinkled on top.
I can definitely pick up a little bit of the spicy cayenne heat that you're talking about. And there's definitely a lot less of the light, fruity corn characteristics.
We say this guy goes on the dark side. This is the darker side of bourbon. So when we're blending it, we're looking for the tobacco, the prune, a little bit more spice to it.
And I don't know if it's because you said it, but now I get the Mexican chocolate, like the kind of milk chocolate, like really creamy, which is kind of weird to be talking about a bourbon as creamy. But
and that's I know we tend to get a lot of mouthfeel out of our whiskeys. Just one, they're pot still. They have a giant Scottish style pot still with a pretty sharp downward angle off the top of it. So it's going to allow a lot of those oils to come through in the distillate. So it makes it's a little bit more mouthfeel. And then everything from us is non-chilled filtered too, so it's going to maintain a little bit more creaminess in the feel, velvety. Yeah. Sometimes. Yeah.
Do you guys use the same types of barrels for all of your aging?
No, that's a great question. Actually, we have a pretty wide variety of barrels. So first and foremost, we don't use just American oak. We'll also use European oak. I did throw one bourbon or one barrel of French oak away too. So I had to do that kind of in the cover of night because French oak's expensive and they didn't want bourbon.
And so we have a wide range of different chars and toasts that we use. Primarily though, we use like char one or char two barrels. We like, especially with the heat here in Texas. The higher charred barrels, it tends to be more reductive than actually helping out the whiskey. So, I mean, even when we pull whiskey from the same basically style of barrel from two different chars right next to each other, they're going to be much lighter and actually have less flavor in the higher chars. So we prefer char one, maybe do a toast before it gets charred. But definitely prefer the lower end of the char spectrum. Mm.
That is really unusual as well. There's so many of the distilleries I go into, they're just like, hey, I throw it in that into New American Oak Char 4. There's no questions about it. Everything goes into that.
Wow.
Where, yeah, a few years ago I was there and had one of their whiskeys that came out of a Char 1. They said it was a toast slash Char 1. It's beautiful. You get a lot of those subtle, berry, fruity flavors on your nose and your palate.
When do you make that choice? Do you wait until it's coming off the still and as you're tasting it, decide what kind of barrel it's going to go into?
Normally when we're doing experiments, we started out with kind of a shotgun approach. And we would basically take four different styles of barrels and then put distillate in those guys and kind of see how those turned out. And so from that, we have specific mash bills normally get paired with specific cooperage. So like we like to put our purple corn mash bill in European oak. It goes perfectly well in American oak, but there's kind of a combination of baking spice notes that you get out of both of them that we really, really like. It builds the complexity dramatically by putting that one in European oak.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. Man, I add a little water to this, mm-hmm. just a little skosh. Yeah. And again, I don't know if it's because the boy said it already, but that some of that
more chocolate
a little bit, but like cocoa powder, and maybe it's more of the tannin and kind of those dark leathery flavors. But okay. I don't know. It's something I've never had before.
Can you put whiskey in a French oak barrel and call it bourbon, or does it have to be American oak?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Actually, the regulations just say it has to be in a brand new charred oak container.
Okay. Doesn't specify where the oak.
I love the word container. And because of that, some people are making square barrels and they're square containers and putting whiskey in them. But
how does that come out? I mean, is there a shape difference? You know, but with how the kind of liquid. Matures inside?
Well, square is different than a circle.
Typical round barrel. It actually allows for airflow underneath them when you rack them.
Okay.
And that airflow is actually pretty important as far as kind of moving out the stagnant air from in between those barrels. You're going to get a lot better basically transition of air from inside the barrel to outside. And so basically it's kind of like refreshing them. That way you don't get kind of that just stagnant alcohol sitting in there. So that's something that we were more kind of drilled into us by Nancy Fraley on the brandy side.
I'm just going to chop an oak tree down and drill it out the center and char that, and that's where I'll store when I open my distillery. Yeah. That's how I'm going to age my beer, just in trees.
Do that.
Yeah, it might all evaporate, but you'll have done it.
Or zigzag, I don't know. I mean, we're going to try new stuff. Why not?
Yeah.
Let's throw some money at it.
Do you guys do any temperature control for your barrel storage being in Texas?
The only temper control we do is since the barrel warehouse does have a sprinkler system in it, we do maintain it above 40 degrees just because we don't want it to the lines to freeze and cause all sorts of havoc in the barrel room. But other than that, we kind of let nature do its thing here. Now, our building is insulated, so it's not going to get quite the drastic temperatures that you're going to see in South Texas, like a Balcones or a Garrison Brothers. So we have quite a bit more moderate of a conditions than what they're going to have, but we still do see like a 9% angel share a year. So, I mean, it's still quite drastic, the amount that we lose, the amount of action that we see in the warehouse in the course of a year, which is actually what's caused us. We've just recently over the last, basically starting last year, started shifting a little bit more and more to larger barrels. So the standard size is the 53 gallon. Actually moved up to 63 gallon. The one that will help kind of slow down the extraction rate a little bit and also help us out a little bit with angel share. So, because our goal is not to get whiskey out as quickly as possible. Ours, we've kind of had, again, from the, you know, Nancy and from Uber kind of got beat into us the notion of slowing things down and taking your time. And so, goal is to have 6- and 8-year-old whiskeys, and basically it's been the first couple of years have really been experimentation on our side is how do we get there given where we're at in the world.
You know,
One of the concepts that Nancy Fraley talks about regularly is élevage. It's like, these are your babies, and how do you raise them up? And, okay. You know, the goal isn't just
abuse, really, but yeah.
The goal isn't just to get to 2 years as fast as you can. The goal is to make the best spirit at the end of this time and do what's right for that spirit, that barrel, that aging process.
Okay. So I should stop screaming at my kid, right? Hurry up. Do the things I'm telling you to do.
Get a job.
Yeah. Well, that must be difficult because you want to push out spirits to sell. You want to make money at this thing. This is what you're doing it
ideally.
For. Yeah, ideally, right? But you also want to have enough to age. So how do you find that balance?
It's a tough balance to find. I mean, when you're running a business and having to stay in business. But for us, it's always been making sure we're producing enough that we know that we can slowly start selling whiskeys. Like, we just started to do larger and larger releases. So, I mean, if you look at the Promethean label on it, it says 16 months old. The reality is that whiskey is actually much older than that.
I think I crossed theirs out. Okay. Wrote the correct date.
Normally, if people out there see a Promethean on the shelf, the age statement on the bottle will say 16 months.
Okay, yeah, this says 2 years.
Yeah, the youngest is going to, from this last batch, I think was 28 or 29 months.
I just wrote 2 years
two
on
years
it.
2 years, yeah.
Okay.
So basically, we are going to turn the Promethean into a straight whiskey. That is one thing that if we didn't have the government shut down, that we would be getting changed right now. But so until then, we're gonna use our old labels and just give people a little bit of extra age without them knowing it. So,
okay. All right, fair enough. I like that.
So our goal and the way that we do release is that every time we release a whiskey, it will be older than the last iteration of that particular whiskey.
And hopefully tastier.
Yeah, that's always the goal. Yes. So that's generally it's, you know, 3 or 4 months older than the last release that we did of that particular whiskey itself.
Okay. Barrel management. I don't know, something I never really thought about. How does a young distillery push out old product while still making money and pushing out current product?
Yeah, you have bills to pay now.
We basically look at that barrel room like a big savings account. Right. A lot of capital out front to put it in there, but knowing it's going to pay off eventually. So realistically, we've been overproducing for the last year or two for what we're actually putting out into the market, knowing full well that we need it to age up.
Right, right.
Did you guys just sell a lot of moonshine the first couple of years? Or what did you guys do to
make it through? We did vodka, we did gin.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, we do.
Do you still do those lines, vodka and gin? And
We do a little bit of gin and vodka still. Moonshine's pretty much over and done with. Yeah. Once we had aged whiskey, there's not a whole lot of reason for the unaged spirit to be out there on the market. We still have it at the distillery and use it in cocktails and stuff like that.
Okay.
Pretty much the main focus is on the aged spirits and ultimately the brandy when it comes out and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. The care you're putting into the mash bill is carrying through to the barrel selection, and you want those notes to be, to be noticed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I appreciate that.
What's the timeline on the brandy 20 years from now?
Yeah, they haven't even offered me any yet.
The brandy right now is 4 years old. Again, we keep tasting it every year and just kind of – we're just holding and holding and holding because that's – the brandy is really more of a passion project for us. It's not something we're ever going to make any real money on just because the cost of grapes versus grain is.
Yeah, raw material cost for us right now, I can make 10 barrels of bourbon or 1 barrel of brandy.
Wow.
and then
sell 10 times as much as well.
The price point's flipped on it when you go to sell it. So it's worth more than brandy right now in the U.S. So.
Wow.
But this love affair with brandy and obviously with all the training we've been doing, so it's. Slowly putting more and more barrels of brandy away. I think ultimately it'll become like a 7 or 8 year old Solera that we'll be doing ultimately with it.
Oh,
so.
That sounds cool.
Can't wait.
Yeah, that sounds really great. Let's try our third spirit, Warren.
All right.
Absolutely.
Next up's going to be Harbinger, the big one. So it's going to be 115 proof.
All right. Tell me a little about this guy.
So now we're going back to the purple corn and bloody butcher corn emphasis.
All right.
You have a little bit more European oak in this blend than you do for the regular from the XC.
Slightly older, too.
Yeah, and it's going to be slightly older whiskey.
In the future, I hope to push the age statement up on this much more so than the 90 proof version.
It does have less of kind of the wood sugars and the vanilla mm-hmm. characteristics that the XC did.
Wow.
And so is this a barrel strength? Is this what it comes out?
Not quite.
Just under.
Yeah, more for logistical reasons with distributors and pushing stuff out, we decided to kind of standardize the proof on it. And so it's going to be – our original versions were coming out of the barrel.
116.
Yeah, we did 116.5, a 118.5, and then finally 115. So
it is surprising how much that one proof – one or two proof difference makes in how the spirit comes across.
And that's for us, we found that 115 is a proof that even people that aren't used to cask strength, like it's not so beyond what they can handle. And yet it's still going to carry a lot of the flavor that you're going to see in those, in the cask strength whiskeys. For us, we do a little bit lower, entry proof on the barrels. Just because we like a little, some of those softer notes you get with a little bit more water in the barrel versus the, you know, what you pull out at 125.
All right, does the proof typically go up in your barrel?
It does.
Okay.
So, and as we're increasing our age statements, the proof was going to continue to go up and up and up. And so by the time we start getting into 120, 121 proof range, it cuts a little bit of the bourbon population out of there on what they can handle. Mm-hmm.
That's a great spirit, man.
Yeah,
that is very very complex, sweet but not overly sweet. And when, does that corn, do you think, kind of lend a little dryness as well, or am I making that up?
Does, and European oak also helps out a lot.
Oh, so okay.
European oak, in contrast to the American oak, is going to have a little bit more tannin content. It's going to have a little bit reduced vanilla that you're going to pull out of it. Mm-hmm. And then it also, it doesn't have kind of a typical, they call it a coconut note that you get in the American oak. So okay. it doesn't have the same structure. So it's missing the lactone to have that flavor, period. So it dries it out a little bit.
Which, when you're dealing with mash bills, are a lot higher percentage of corn. It really helps out on balancing it out that we've found, and that's why we use about 30 or 40% of our barrels are actually European oak.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, you don't find it real typically for people to use the European oak. I mean, aside from just flavor profile differences, it is a little more expensive. And so if you only make bourbon at your facility, it's a problem because if it's two or three times the cost in barrels, it doesn't make much sense. But because we make the corn whiskey, because we actually lay down some single malt, we don't have any out yet, and we've got a couple other projects that are going to go into used casks, it makes more financial sense for us to do that. Mm.
I do like the blend versus some corn whiskeys, just with the sweetness of the corn and the heavy vanillins and everything, it just becomes too sweet to me. And I really like how you guys are blending in some of the European oak to kind of cut that with some extra tannins.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's delicious.
Yeah.
I mean, because you look at the thing, you go, oh, man, 115, this is going to be a huge thing. And, you know, it is. Don't get me wrong. There's a lot of heat there, but there's a lot of flavors. Yeah. But it's kind of encased in this very flavorful container of the corn and the sweetness and the barrel, and everything kind of just comes out right, and it's all elevated, it's all accentuated. I couldn't pick out necessarily one thing sticking out way more than anything else, and some spirits I've tasted, you can kind of get that. It's a little sharper on the edges, but this is, it's full-bodied, it's in your face, but it's all sort of on the same curve, if that makes sense.
I think it is that thing that's so unusual that they are using American oak and French oak and blending it together, which adds just so much complexity to it, where it doesn't stick on one flavor in your mouth the whole way through. On the beginning, the middle, and the end, you're tasting different things as it goes through your palate.
Yeah, yeah. This is wonderful. You guys are doing a good job out there.
Thanks.
You know, if my compliments mean anything. Hey, can you hang on for just a sec? I need to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll finish up. Is that cool?
Sure.
All right. Sure. All right. Awesome. Hang on, everybody. This is Heads and Tails. We're talking with Iron Root Republic Distillery in Denison, Texas. We're almost done. Quick break. We'll come right back. Polish up. Everything will be good.
Yeah. Two more whiskeys.
That's right. All right, everybody. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. right, welcome back, everybody. Thanks for sticking with us through the break. We're here, of course, with Jonathan and Robert from Iron Root Republic Distilling. Jesus Christ.
the bourbon's real good.
Yeah, hey, up the proof on these guys. Come on.
We're about to.
No.
Distilling. It's a new topic I have. A new conversation.
That's how we get to Texas.
That's right. All right. What's the? We have two final spirits to run through. What should we do first?
Do Hubris goes first on out of these two.
Hubris. All right.
So this one's labeled as a corn whiskey, and we've been having bourbon.
Right. So
what is the difference?
So basically, when you have corn whiskey, or let's start with bourbon. So bourbon has to be 51% corn. Put into that brand new charred oak barrel and made in the United States. In order for it to be corn whiskey has to be 80% corn, but that's actually not the big difference. Most of our bourbons have more than 80% corn in them. The big difference is in the cooperage. So it has to go into either a used charred barrel or a non-charred barrel. So it can go into, say, a toasted barrel if you wanted to. We don't have a whole lot of toasted barrels sitting around here. So for us, it pretty much means it goes into our used bourbon barrels.
Okay.
So Hubris specifically is going to be our purple corn mash bill, aged exclusively in European oak. So this is going to give you a really good idea when we talk about how that marriage of those to that mash bill and that cooperage, like we felt, just went perfectly together. This is the purest expression of that. So the story kind of behind Hubris is we were starting out, you know, we're about a year and a few months old at that time. And we're tasting through barrels and with Nancy Fraley, and we ran into this one barrel that was just what we felt was fantastic and absolutely wonderful. And so I talked my brother into dumping that barrel and then submitting it into a competition because I thought it was fantastic. And again, so that's where Jonathan said I was foolish and that, you know, it's a 16-month-old whiskey at the time.
I said it was hubris to enter that.
we ended up entering into a couple competitions, and it just did fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the first one it hit was San Francisco World Spirits Competition.
And I got double gold, won best in class there.
Wow.
So I said, I guess we named it right.
And then it went on to the World Whiskey Awards, that's Whiskey Magazine's competition, and it won Best Corn Whiskey in the World. So it was, so we're like, all right, we definitely named it correctly. And so
wow.
Became a staple thing that we release every year now. And so this is, again, it's one of my favorite releases we do every year. It's a fairly small release. We only do a few barrels of it a year, generally released in December. And for us, it always sells out at the distillery that day, and then when it hits the market, it's generally a few months and it's gone. So,
talk about hitting a grand slam out the door. Woo!
Well, and it's funny because it's one of those things. It's corn whiskey, and so corn whiskey is kind of like the redheaded stepchild of whiskey world, which is fitting with us making it, I guess. And so it's just something that we kind of fell in love with. And so then we'll talk about how that kind of evolves into Icarus when we get to
it. Kind of the journey with corn whiskey, it's like Robert was saying, it's always kind of been almost a demonized side of aged spirit. So it's, you know, often referred to as corn liquor, things like that. And so the whole kind of concept with doing a corn whiskey and trying to do it well and trying to kind of elevate that category. There's been a few people who have kind of started down that path before us, and that kind of some of those acted as mentors to us as well. And so, but we wanted to kind of continue that tradition. And so you'll see it in this product, and then you'll see as we transition into the next one.
The bottle that we have says it was aged 29 months. What do you think has changed between the 16 month that won all those awards and this one?
This one's richer. It's honestly, it's a lot deeper of the spirit. It's gotten obviously a little bit more oak. I mean, you can just tell just off the color of this is a used barrel and it's still giving that much color.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a little bit heavier, bigger, bolder version of that original spirit. And that's every year we always taste it against that very first one, what we're choosing, what we're looking at doing.
Okay. Yeah.
So, are, and when we're sitting at the blending table, if we don't think it's better than that first one, then it won't get released. So that's always our goal, is to make sure it's better than the ones we've previously released.
This isn't one of necessarily your flagships. How many flagships do you guys have that are available year-round versus
The two year-round ones are going to be Promethean and then the XC.
Okay.
The other three are going to be Harbinger. We're actually released quite a bit more of that this year than we did last year. So it should be like two, maybe three releases this year of that. We're actually getting ready to do another release of it here in April. And then around the country, we just started shipping stuff to Total Wine. So it actually... the Total Wines around the country now should have a little bit of the Harbinger, the 115 proof on shelf right now.
Yeah, they should get the pair of Harbingers, so the set.
Aren't you guys like tiny? What are you doing in Total Wines across the country? What's going on over there?
You know, it's one of those things that we've been really fortunate through making good whiskey and having the right people find us at the right time.
Yeah.
It's one of those things like one of the stories, you don't have this whiskey in front of you because it's technically not our whiskey anymore, but it's
it was.
Yeah. We sent it over to be bottled for them.
Yeah.
We actually do a product with Berry Brothers and Rudd over in the UK called Texas Legation.
Okay.
And it's a crazy product that they – Barry, short story on it, Barry Brothers and Rudd's been around since 1698, which is ungodly long time to be in the same building.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy to think about that. But in 1842, they rented out their second floor of their building to the country of Texas as part of the embassy that was close to the royal palaces. And so to honor that, they wanted to release a Texas whiskey. So they had been searching for a true 100% made in Texas whiskey for a number of years. And so they sent us an email, and it was a couple days before Christmas, a couple of years ago. Again, it's right around the time, actually it was before Hubris had won any of the awards. And we sent them a couple of barrel samples, and we hadn't even released whiskey ourselves. And we were like, you know, why not shoot the breeze a little bit? And next thing I know, we're getting a phone call with a guy with a heavy Scotch accent telling us how much he liked our whiskey and that they wanted to do a product where they do their own blend of our whiskey. And so every year we send them barrel samples, and they kind of come up with their own blend of our different mash bills. And then they release that as Texas Legation around the world. So that's sold in the UK and France, Germany, and Taiwan.
Taiwan is here.
Sign stuff.
That's a cool story.
Yeah, it's crazy that there's a lot of countries we can go to actually find our whiskey.
That's got to be a trip. I mean,
way more impressed than we should.
Yeah. Did you ever just sit and think about that, like over a drink at the end of the day? Like, man, we're pumping out world class spirits, and that you can find internationally. Like 5 years ago, if I had told you that this is going to be happening to you 5 years from now, would you believe it? I mean, that's a crazy story.
I would have laughed at you. I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of.
Right? Yeah. Well, but you guys are doing it. I think that's amazing.
And now you guys are ambassadors to the country of Texas again.
That's right. Congratulations on your appointment.
Over there, for the release of the first batch, they actually flew the Texas flag over the top of the store.
These people sound crazy.
As they should.
They sound insane.
They're like a block away from St. James Palace, so they had to ask permission from the crown in order to fly the Texas flag. Otherwise, I guess it would be an act of war.
Right. They didn't want to start anything.
Yeah, we're back.
Oh, geez, that would be narrowly missing an international incident.
Yeah.
That's right.
That alone is pretty... man, I like that story a lot. That's a good story, man. All right, let's hit this Icarus.
All right, yeah.
Staring at me, my Greek roots are rooting for this.
You Icarus. Guys already polished off the Hubris?
Yes.
I'm a little behind.
Well, polished is relative.
Well, yeah, we're not finishing these by any means. But,
that's for after the show.
That's right.
You should have said that before we started.
Yeah. Look, we're from California. We don't really go very hard, but Eric is here. He's pounding them. So
eating all these soybeans doesn't give us a good base.
That's true. It's actually called edamame. Okay? Oh,
sorry, I'm a transplant.
Yeah, geez, what's going on with you?
It's not food shame here.
All right, Icarus. What's special about this one?
So this guy was developed actually out in California. We were there with Nancy Fraley drinking. She has you need to get her on the show because she will bring some crazy old Armagnacs around because
I'm ready
she
for
has
it.
The best collection of Armagnac if you're ever interested in that spirit.
I really am, actually.
The best collection, period.
Way to ruin the surprise, guys. She might be coming up.
Well, she's got stuff that was made in the 1800s, and so we're out there enjoying that, enjoying a nice California night, and Jonathan kind of got a crazy idea. We were talking about how corn whiskey is kind of the redheaded stepchild of the whiskey world.
I like to refer to it as the popper.
And if you think of what's the most highly regarded whiskey category, and that's going to be Scotch. And so we're like, well, what would happen if someone were to take a corn whiskey and treat it like it was a high end Scotch?
So popper to prince, basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so. What are some of the tenets of the Scotch whiskeys? Well, what Jonathan and I love in Scotch whiskey generally, I really love Big Peat, and he loves a lot of the wine finish casks. So we're like, well, why don't we do something that incorporates both those things that are so great about Scotch whiskey?
Yeah.
And we ended up taking some Hubris. And
Nancy got really excited at this point. She started breaking out graduated cylinders and beakers.
Yeah.
We were probably on our about 13th really old Armagnac at that point. So she busted that out and some of the Hubris corn whiskey that you guys tried a second ago.
Mm-hmm. And we
got to work.
Yeah. So what we ended up doing is taking Hubris, and we will actually take it after a couple of years, and we will put it in ex Islay peated malt barrels.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Some of it will go in an old port barrel that we have, a big port butt.
It's a 500-liter tiny port.
Yeah.
From 1976.
Wow. Okay.
Big old barrel.
It's the sexiest thing in the barrel.
What are you guys doing?
You guys are crazy.
Jeez.
And so we will age it in there. We actually aged this guy in there for over a year in those barrels.
Okay.
We took it back out of those barrels, blended it back together, and then put it back in its original barrels, and have now let it rest another 5-6 months now. And so that's what you're tasting right now. It's something that I think we're getting ready to release here in April or May.
Yeah, so the one I sent you is actually a barrel sample out of one of those barrels. And I think it was about 35 months old when I sent it to you guys. So it'll be celebrating its third birthday.
Yeah.
Well,
right now,
almost as old as my son.
I can't think of a better way to toast this spirit than to drink it.
Yeah,
that's good. Cheers. I love that Pete character coming through. That is rad.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the port character in there too. Because sometimes, to me, I love Scotch, but go heavy on the peat, and I'm not the biggest fan. But the port character really helps. With the peat in this,
what it does, like sweeten it up a bit, or
yeah.
I haven't been the biggest fan of the big peaty scotches, and this is definitely your gateway into those. It's peaty, but it's not over the top, blowing out your senses, smoke, campfire type thing. It's just a nice flavor in the rest of the flavors.
But it's still somehow very American. You know what I mean?
We appreciate that.
That's
very Texan.
Yeah, you got that. You got the smoke, but you got that big malt. You got that spice coming through. Also, you got some of that heat, and not that everything made in America has to be like in your face or whatever. But it's a very nice balance. I mean, considering it's a barrel sample, I guess that's fine. But you guys have hit a really delicate balance. I would think that'd be very hard to blend, but it tastes like you did it.
This one actually took us, we've been blending for 6 months on this particular one, using a lot of the techniques that we got from the brandy side of things. And so we're pretty happy with it. It actually kind of flips things on the head, where I'm kind of the gas on the creative side and Rob's more the brake on the business side.
Right.
I become the brake on this one because he wants to add more and more peat.
I'm with you on that, man. I really like peat.
So, I'm not opposed to it. It's just I'm all about the balance on this one.
Yeah. This makes me really want some good smoky barbecue.
Blend. It just, like, you can blend it, and then sometimes it'll hide itself for a little bit, and then if you let it sit for a day or two, that's when it will start showing itself again. So it's one of those things where you're like, oh, what if we added a little bit more peat here? well, then we have to wait a day or two before we can actually go back and test it.
Okay.
Not to mention when you're tasting a bunch of peated stuff in a row, you become kind of immune to peat, or you taste it less.
Oh, yeah, so, sure.
It's like a mutant ability.
Yeah, the more I drink it, the more I'm peat. That's
bad. Man, how do you think this would pair with barbecue, Warren? I think it may be too much.
I think I will have way too much barbecue and way too much of this whenever I do pair it.
I always call this snooty barbecue in a glass. So.
Yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
So it took 6 months for the blending. Is that just because of the kind of palate fatigue and needing to go slow
with
tasting? Okay.
There's that, and like Robert said, there's a little bit of time delay and seeing how that peat is actually going to settle out. Mm. And so we just take a little bit out of each barrel and kind of adjust the blend. And we finally got it to where we liked it, and then put it back into its original cask just to kind of gain a little bit of oxidation on it. So,
wow. Well, I tell you what, guys, these are all really, really good.
Thank you very much.
They're really good. I appreciate what you're doing. You know, you're bringing some different flavors to the game, and keep doing it. Like I'm encouraging, you know, but
the cheerleader,
pinch your cheek.
Yeah, that's right. But I really appreciate it, man. It's I like this kind of movement in craft spirits now to just bring different flavors to the table and see what else we can sort of get away with, I guess. I say we, like get I'm like with. I'm doing anything.
Like you're rubbing
and so yeah. we can find your stuff out here too. Like you said, you're in Total Wine, and so everybody else can also find you.
Correct. Yeah, you should be able to find us in Total Wine. At least the Harbinger line will be in Total Wine out there. Right. Should be right now. I just got a message from someone in Tucson yesterday saying they found it. So
Hopefully
it's in there.
Awesome. And people can come out and see you, right? You have like tours and a whole facility for visitors, right?
Oh, yeah, we do every Saturday at 1, we do tours. The first Saturday of the month, we have like a big Bloody Mary bar, cocktail lounge, food trucks, you know, the whole, whole thing. It's a lot of fun. And then and a couple times a year, we actually host something we call Whiskey Camp that people can come out and basically spend a day with us distilling, tasting stuff off the still, learning about what the different oaks do and how whiskeys change over time in barrels. It's a lot of fun, and it's definitely one of our most fun weekends whenever we do it, because you get to hang out with people for the whole day and just drink a lot of whiskey.
Great. Well, I love camping.
Yeah.
I'll see you then. And whiskey.
Yeah. I don't necessarily like hanging out with a bunch of people, but, that sounds like a blast to me.
Yeah. I think the only camping aspect is really we put a fire in the fire pit out front.
Yeah, I'm just going to take a car to the hotel.
That's generally how it happens.
Yeah, I'm good off of that. All right, Jonathan and Robert from Iron Root Republic in Denison, Texas, and you can find more. What is your URL? I had it up right now. It's ironrootrepublic.com. I appreciate you guys joining us. I appreciate the samples.
Yes.
Everything's really great. You guys were a hoot, and if we're ever out in that area, we'll definitely stop by. And if you're ever here, come on in. We'll do a live show.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Either way, sounds outstanding.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
You too.
All right, bye. That was cool. It was good stuff.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
This actually kind of inspired me to get back into bourbon. I'd kind of written it off as just boring.
That wasn't me. That was Eric.
there are an outlier in there. There's not a lot of bourbons that taste like this. There's no bourbons where they are aging them in French oak that I know of, but maybe there are some out there.
Okay, so then maybe I won't get back into bourbon, and I'll just have this.
Stay in these.
Yes, stay in these.
Oh, okay. All right.
But I think for the most part, we have to go to Texas to get them, which I'm okay with doing that.
Okay. That's a trip.
It's definitely a trip, dude. Yeah, that was good stuff.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to get out of here, everybody. Thanks a lot again to Jonathan and Robert from Iron Root Republic.
The Licorice Brothers.
If you're ever out there, Denison, Texas, North Texas, definitely hit them up. Go online and check out their facility. It looks beautiful.
Yeah.
And thanks to Eric from ADI for hanging out with us
and
drinking some of these spirits. And until next time, we'll see you guys later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.